Although the extraterrestrials could not have known how much each crew member weighed, they specified in painstaking detail the mass of each machine component and the total permissible mass. Very little was left over for equipment of terrestrial design. This fact had some years before been used as an argument for an all-woman crew, so that the equipment allowance could be increased. But the suggestion had been rejected as frivolous. There was no room for spacesuits. They would have to hope the Vegans would remember that humans had a propensity for breathing oxygen. With virtually no equipment of their own, with their cultural differences and their unknown destination, it was clear that the mission might entail great risk. The world press discussed it often. The five themselves, never. A variety of miniature cameras, spectrometers, superconducting supercomputers, and microfilm libraries were being urged on the crew. It made sense, and it didn't make sense. There were no sleeping or cooking or toilet facilities on board the machine. They were taking only a minimum of provisions, some of them stuffed in the pockets of their coveralls. Davy was to carry a rudimentary medical kit. As far as she was concerned, Ellie thought, she was barely planning to bring a toothbrush and a change of underwear. If they can get me to Vega in a chair, she thought, they'll probably be able to provide the amenities as well. If she needed a camera, she told project officials, she'd just ask the Vegans for one. There was a body of opinion, apparently serious, that the five should go naked, since clothing had not been specified it should not be included, because it might somehow disturb the functioning of the machine. Ellie and Davy, among many others, were amused and noted that there was no prescription against wearing clothing, a popular human custom evident in the Olympic broadcast. The Vegans knew we wore clothes, she and Vega protested. The only restrictions were on total mass. Should we also extract dental work, they asked, and leave eyeglasses behind? Their view carried the day, in part because of the reluctance of many nations to be associated with a project culminating so indecorously. But the debate generated a little raw humor among the press, the technicians, and the five. For that matter, Lunacharsky said, it doesn't actually specify that human beings are to go. Maybe they would find five chimpanzees equally acceptable. Even a single two-dimensional photograph of an alien machine could be invaluable, she was told. And imagine a picture of the aliens themselves. Would she please reconsider and bring a camera? Trahir, who was now on Hokkaido with a large American delegation, told her to be serious. The stakes were too high, he said, but she cut him short with a look so withering that he could not complete the sentence. In her mind, she knew what he was going to say. For childish behavior. Amazingly, Trahir was acting as if he had been the injured party in their relationship. She described it all to Davy, who was not fully sympathetic. Trahir, she said, was very sweet. Eventually, Ellie agreed to take an ultra-miniaturized video camera. In the manifest that the project required under personal effects, she listed frond, palm, 0.811 kilograms. Trahir was sent to reason with her. You know there's a splendid infrared imaging system you can carry along for 0.75 kilograms. Why would you want to take the branch of a tree? A frond. It's a palm frond. I know you grew up in New York, but you must know what a palm tree is. It's all in Ivanhoe. Didn't you read it in high school? At the time of the Crusades, pilgrims who made the long journey to the Holy Land took back a palm frond to show they'd really been there. It's to keep my spirits up. I don't care how advanced they are, the earth is my Holy Land. I'll bring a frond to them to show them where I came from. Trahir only shook his head. But when she described her reasons to Vega, he said, this I understand very well. Ellie remembered Vega's concerns, and the story he had told her in Paris about the droshky sent to the impoverished village. But this was not her worry at all. The palm frond served another purpose, she realized. She needed something to remind her of Earth. She was afraid she might be tempted not to come back. The day before the machine was to be activated, she received a small package that had been delivered by hand to her apartment on the site in Wyoming and transshipped by courier. There was no return address, and inside no note and no signature. The package held a gold medallion on a chain. Conceivably, it could be used as a pendulum. An inscription had been engraved on both sides, small but readable. One side read, "Hera, superb queen with the golden robes, commanded Argus, whose glances bristle out through the world." On the obverse, she read, "This is the response of the defenders of Sparta to the commander of the Roman army. If you are a god, you will not hurt those who have never injured you. If you are a man, advance, and you will find men equal to yourself." And women. She knew who had sent it. Next day, activation day, they took an opinion poll of the senior staff on what would happen. Most thought nothing would happen, that the machine would not work. A smaller number believed that the five would somehow find themselves very quickly in the Vega system, relativity to the contrary notwithstanding. Others suggested variously that the machine was a vehicle for exploring the solar system, the most expensive practical joke in history, a classroom, a time machine, or a galactic telephone booth. One scientist wrote, "Five very ugly replacements with green scales and sharp teeth will slowly materialize in the chairs." This was the closest to the Trojan horse scenario in any of the responses. Another, but only one, read, "Doomsday machine." There was a ceremony of sorts. Speeches were made, food and drink were served. People hugged one another. Some cried quietly. Only a few were openly skeptical. You could sense that if anything at all happened on activation, the response would be thunderous. There was an intimation of joy in many faces. Ellie managed to call the nursing home and wish her mother goodbye. She spoke the word into the mouthpiece on Hokkaido, and in Wisconsin the identical sound was generated. But there was no response. Her mother was recovering some motor functions on her stricken side, the nurse told her. Soon she might be able to speak a few words. By the time the call had been completed, Ellie was feeling almost lighthearted. The Japanese technicians were wearing hachimaki, cloth bands around their heads, that were traditionally donned in preparation for mental, physical, or spiritual effort, especially combat. Printed on the headband was a conventional projection of the map of the Earth. No single nation held a dominant position. There had not been much in the way of national briefings. As far as she could tell, no one had been urged to rally round the flag. National leaders sent short statements on videotape. The president's was especially fine, Ellie thought. "This is not a briefing, and not a farewell. It's just a so long. Each of you makes this journey on behalf of 1 billion souls. You represent all the peoples of the planet Earth. If you are to be transported to somewhere else, then see for all of us, not just the science, but everything you can learn. You represent the entire human species, past, present, and future. Whatever happens, your place in history is secure. You are heroes of our planet. Speak for all of us. Be wise. And come back." A few hours later, for the first time, they entered the machine. One by one through a small airlock. Recessed interior lights, very low key, came on. Even after the machine had been completed and had passed every prescribed test, they were afraid to have the five take their places prematurely. Some project personnel worried that merely sitting down might induce the machine to operate even if the Benzels were stationary. But here they were, and nothing extraordinary was happening so far. This was the first moment she was able to lean back, a little gingerly to be sure, into the molded and cushioned plastic. She had wanted chintz. Chintz slipcovers would have been perfect for these chairs. But even this, she discovered, was a matter of national pride. The plastic seemed more modern, more scientific, more serious. Knowing of Vega's careless smoking habits, they had decreed that no cigarettes could be carried on board the machine. Lunacharsky had uttered fluent maledictions in 10 languages. Now he entered after the others, having finished his last lucky strike. He wheezed just a little as he sat down beside her. There were no seat belts in the design extracted from the message, so there were none in the machine. Some project personnel had argued, nevertheless, that it was foolhardy to omit them. The machine goes somewhere, she thought. It was a means of conveyance, an aperture to elsewhere, or else when. It was a freight train barreling and wailing into the night. If you had climbed aboard, it could carry you out of the stifling provincial towns of your childhood to the great crystal cities. It was discovery and escape and an end to loneliness. Every logistical delay in manufacture and every dispute over the proper interpretation of some subcodicil of the instructions had plunged her into despair. It was not glory she was seeking, not mainly, not much, but instead a kind of liberation. She was a wonder junkie. In her mind, she was a hill tribesman, standing slack-jawed before the real Ishtar Gate of ancient Babylon. Dorothy catching her first glimpse of the vaulted spires of the Emerald City of Oz. A small boy from darkest Brooklyn plunged down in the corridor of nations of the 1939 World's Fair, the Trilon and Perisphere beckoning in the distance. She was Pocahontas, sailing up the Thames estuary, with London spread out before her from horizon to horizon. Her heart sang in anticipation. She would discover, she was sure, what else is possible. What could be accomplished by other beings, great beings. Beings who had, it seemed likely, been voyaging between the stars when the ancestors of humans were still brachiating from branch to branch in the dappled sunlight of the forest canopy. Drumlin, like many others she had known over the years, had called her an incurable romantic. And she found herself wondering again why so many people thought it some embarrassing disability. Her romanticism had been a driving force in her life and a fount of delights. Advocate and practitioner of romance, she was off to see the wizard. A status report came through by radio. There were no apparent malfunctions, so far as could be detected with the battery of instrumentation that had been set up exterior to the machine. Their main wait was for the evacuation of the space between and around the Benzels. A system of extraordinary efficiency was pumping out the air to attain the highest vacuum ever reached on Earth. She double-checked the stowage of her video microcamera system and gave the palm frond a pat. Powerful lights on the exterior of the dodecahedron had turned on. Two of the spherical shells had now spun up to what the message had defined as critical speed. They were already a blur to those watching outside. The third Benzel would be there in a minute. A strong electrical charge was building up. When all three spherical shells, with their mutually perpendicular axes, were up to speed, the machine would be activated. Or so the message had said. She's face showed fierce determination, she thought. Lunacharsky's a deliberate calm. Sukhavati's eyes were open wide. Ada revealed only an attitude of quiet attentiveness. Davy caught her glance and smiled. She wished she had had a child. It was her last thought before the walls flickered and became transparent, and it seemed the earth opened up and swallowed her. Part 3. The Galaxy. So I walk on uplands unbounded, and know that there is hope for that which thou didst mold out of dust, to have consort with things eternal. The Dead Sea Scrolls. Chapter 19. Naked Singularity. Mount to Paradise by the Stairway of Surprise. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Merlin, Poems, 1847. It is not impossible that to some infinitely superior being, the whole universe may be as one plane, the distance between planet and planet being only as the pores in a grain of sand, and the spaces between system and system no greater than the intervals between one grain and the grain adjacent. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Omniania. They were falling. The pentagonal panels of the dodecahedron had become transparent. So had the roof and the floor. Above and below, she could make out the organosilicate lacework and the implanted erbium dowels, which seemed to be stirring. All three benzels had disappeared. The dodecahedron plunged, racing down a long, dark tunnel, just broad enough to permit its passage. The acceleration seemed somewhere around 1G. As a result, Ellie, facing forward, was pressed backward in her chair, while Davy, opposite her, was bending slightly at the waist. Perhaps they should have added seatbelts. It was hard not to entertain the thought that they had plunged into the mantle of the earth, bound for its core of molten iron. Or maybe they were on their way straight to... She tried to imagine this improbable conveyance as a ferry boat upon the River Styx. There was a texture to the tunnel walls, from which she could sense their speed. The patterns were irregular, soft-edged mottlings, nothing with a well-defined form. The walls were not memorable for their appearance, only for their function. Even a few hundred kilometers beneath the Earth's surface, the rocks would be glowing with red heat. There was no hint of that. No minor demons were managing the traffic, and no cupboards with jars of marmalade were in evidence. Every now and then, a forward vertex of the dodecahedron would brush the wall, and flakes of an unknown material would be scraped off. The dodec itself seemed unaffected. Soon, quite a cloud of fine particles was following them. Every time the dodecahedron touched the wall, she could sense an undulation, as if something soft had retreated to lessen the impact. The faint yellow lighting was diffuse, uniform. Occasionally, the tunnel would swerve gently, and the dodec would obligingly follow the curvature. Nothing, so far as she could see, was headed toward them. At these speeds, even a collision with a sparrow would produce a devastating explosion. Or what if this was an endless fall into a bottomless well? She could feel a continuous physical anxiety in the pit of her stomach. Even so, she entertained no second thoughts. Black hole, she thought. Black hole. I'm falling through the event horizon of a black hole toward the dread singularity. Or maybe this isn't a black hole and I'm headed toward a naked singularity. That's what the physicists called it, a naked singularity. Near a singularity, causality could be violated. Effects could precede causes, time could flow backward, and you were unlikely to survive, much less remember the experience. For a rotating black hole, she dredged up from her studies years before, there was not a point but a ring singularity or something still more complex to be avoided. Black holes were nasty. The gravitational tidal forces were so great that you would be stretched into a long, thin thread if you were so careless as to fall in. You would also be crushed laterally. Happily, there was no sign of any of this. Through the gray, transparent surfaces that were now the ceiling and floor, she could see a great flurry of activity. The organosilicate matrix was collapsing on itself in some places and unfolding in others. The embedded erbium dowels were spinning and tumbling. Everything inside the dodec, including herself and her companions, looked quite ordinary. Well, maybe a bit excited. But they were not yet long, thin threads. These were idle ruminations, she knew. The physics of black holes was not her field. Anyway, she could not understand how this could have anything to do with black holes, which were either primordial, made during the origin of the universe, or produced in a later epoch by the collapse of a star more massive than the sun. Then the gravity would be so strong that except for quantum effects, even light could not escape, although the gravitational field certainly would remain. Hence, black. Hence, hole. But they hadn't collapsed a star. And she couldn't see any way in which they had captured a primordial black hole. Anyway, no one knew where the nearest primordial black hole might be hiding. They had only built the machine and spun up the benzels. She glanced over to Ada, who was figuring something on a small computer. By bone conduction, she could feel as well as hear a low-pitched roaring every time the dodec scraped the wall, and she raised her voice to be heard. Do you understand what's going on?
Not at all, he shouted back. I can almost prove this can't be happening. Do you know the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates? No, sorry. I'll explain it to you later.
She was glad he thought there would be a later. Ellie felt the deceleration before she could see it, as if they had been on the downslope of a roller coaster, had leveled out, and now were slowly climbing. Just before the deceleration set in, the tunnel had made a complex sequence of bobs and weaves. There was no perceptible change, either in the color or in the brightness of the surrounding light. She picked up her camera, switched to the long focal length lens, and looked as far ahead of her as she could. She could see only to the next jag in the tortuous path. Magnified, the texture of the wall seemed intricate, irregular, and just for a moment, faintly self-luminous. The dodecahedron had slowed to a comparative crawl. No end to the tunnel was in sight. She wondered if they would make it to wherever they were going. Perhaps the designers had miscalculated. Maybe the machine had been built imperfectly, just a little bit off. Perhaps what had seemed on Hokkaido an acceptable technological imperfection would doom their mission to failure here in wherever this was. Or glancing at the cloud of fine particles, following and occasionally overtaking them, she thought maybe they had bumped into the walls one time too often and lost more momentum than had been allowed for in the design. The space between the dodec and the walls seemed very narrow now. Perhaps they would find themselves stuck fast in this never-never land and languish until the oxygen ran out. Could the Vegans have gone to all this trouble and forgotten that we need to breathe? Hadn't they noticed all those shouting Nazis? Vega and Ada were deep in the arcana of gravitational physics. Twisters, renormalization of ghost propagators, time-like killing vectors, non-abelian gauge invariants, geodesic refocusing, 11-dimensional Kaluza-Klein treatments of supergravity, and, of course, Ada's own and quite different super-unification. You could tell at a glance that an explanation was not readily within their grasp. She guessed that in another few hours the two physicists would make some progress on the problem. Superunification embraced virtually all scales and aspects of physics known on Earth. It was hard to believe that this tunnel was not itself some hitherto unrealized solution of the Eda field equations. Vega asked, "Did anyone see a naked singularity?"
"I don't know what one looks like," Davy replied.
"I beg your pardon. It probably wouldn't be naked. Did you sense any causality inversion, anything bizarre, really crazy? Maybe about how you were thinking, anything like scrambled eggs reassembling themselves into whites and yolks?"
Davy looked at Vega through narrowed lids.
"It's okay,"
Ellie quickly interjected. "Vega's a little excited," she added to herself. "These are genuine questions about black holes. They only sound crazy."
"No," replied Davy slowly, "except for the question itself."
But then she brightened.
"In fact, it was a marvelous ride."
They all agreed. Vega was elated.
"This is a very strong version of cosmic censorship," he was saying. "Singularities are invisible even inside black holes."
"Vega is only joking," Ada added. "Once you're inside the event horizon, there is no way to escape the black hole singularity."
Despite Ellie's reassurance, Davy was glancing dubiously at both Vega and Ada. Physicists had to invent words and phrases for concepts far removed from everyday experience. It was their fashion to avoid pure neologisms and instead to evoke, even if feebly, some analogous commonplace. The alternative was to name discoveries and equations after one another. This they did also. But if you didn't know it was physics they were talking, you might very well worry about them. She stood up to cross over to Davy, but at the same moment, she roused them with a shout. The walls of the tunnel were undulating, closing in on the dodecahedron, squeezing it forward. A nice rhythm was being established. Every time the dodec would slow almost to a halt, it was given another squeeze by the walls. She felt a slight motion sickness rising in her. In some places it was tough going. the walls working hard, waves of contraction and expansion rippling down the tunnel. Elsewhere, especially on the straightaways, they would fairly skip along. A great distance away, Ellie made out a dim point of light slowly growing in intensity. A blue-white radiance began flooding the inside of the dodecahedron. She could see it glint off the black erbium cylinders, now almost stationary. Although the journey seemed to have taken only 10 or 15 minutes, the contrast between the subdued, restrained ambient light for most of the trip and the swelling brilliance ahead was striking. They were rushing toward it, shooting up the tunnel, and then erupting into what seemed to be ordinary space. Before them was a huge blue-white sun, disconcertingly close. Ellie knew in an instant it was Vega. She was reluctant to look at it directly through the long focal-length lens. This was foolhardy even for the sun, a cooler and dimmer star. But she produced a piece of white paper, moved it so it was in the focal plane of the long lens, and projected a bright image of the star. She could see two great sunspot groups, and a hint, she thought, a shadow of some of the material in the ring plane. Putting down the camera, she held her hand at arm's length, palm outward, to just cover the disk of Vega, and was rewarded by seeing a brilliant, extended corona around the star. It had been invisible before, washed out in Vega's glare. Palm still outstretched, she examined the ring of debris that surrounded the star. The nature of the Vega system had been the subject of worldwide debate ever since receipt of the prime number message. Acting on behalf of the astronomical community of the planet Earth, she hoped she was not making any serious mistakes. She videotaped at a variety of f-stops and frame speeds. They had emerged almost in the ring plane, in a debris-free circumstellar gap. The ring was extremely thin compared with its vast lateral dimensions. She could make out faint color gradations within the rings, but none of the individual ring particles. If they were at all like the rings of Saturn, a particle a few meters across would be a giant. Perhaps the Vegan rings were composed entirely of specks of dust, clods of rock, shards of ice. She turned around to look back at where they had emerged and saw a field of black, a circular blackness, blacker than velvet, blacker than the night sky. It eclipsed that leeward portion of the Vega ring system which was otherwise, were not obscured by this somber apparition, clearly visible. As she peered through the lens more closely, she thought she could see faint, erratic flashes of light from its very center. Hawking radiation? No. Its wavelength would be much too long. Or light from the planet Earth still rushing down the tube? On the other side of that blackness was Hokkaido. Planets. Where were the planets? She scanned the ring plane with the long focal-length lens, searching for embedded planets, or at least for the home of the beings who had broadcast the message. In each break in the rings, she looked for a shepherding world whose gravitational influence had cleared the lanes of dust. But she could find nothing.
"You can't find any planets?"
she asked.
"Nothing. There's a few big comets in close. I can see the tails, but nothing that looks like a planet. There must be thousands of separate rings. As far as I can tell, they're all made of debris. The black hole seems to have cleared out a big gap in the rings. Well, that's where we are right now, slowly orbiting Vega. The system is very young, only a few 100 million years old, and some astronomers thought it was too soon for there to be planets. But then where did the transmission come from?"
"Maybe this isn't Vega," Vega offered. "Maybe our radio signal comes from Vega, but the tunnel goes to another star system."
"Maybe. But it's a funny coincidence that your other star should have roughly the same color temperature as Vega.
Well, look, you can see it's bluish, and the same kind of debris system.
Oh, it's true, I can't check this out from the constellations because of the glare.
I'd still give you 10-to-1 odds this is Vega."
"But then, where are they?" Devi asked.
She, whose eyesight was acute, was staring up, through the organosilicate matrix, out the transparent pentagonal panels, into the sky, far above the ring plane. He said nothing, and Ellie followed his gaze. There was something there, all right, gleaming in the sunlight and with a perceptible angular size. She looked through the long lens. It was some vast, irregular polyhedron, each of its faces covered with a kind of circle, disc, dish, bowl.
Here. Kiamu, look through here. Tell us what you see.
Yes, I see your counterparts. Radio telescopes. Thousands of them, I suppose, pointing in many directions. It is not a world. It is only a device.
They took turns using the long lens. She concealed her impatience to look again. The fundamental nature of a radio telescope was more or less specified by the physics of radio waves. But she found herself disappointed that a civilization able to make or even just use black holes for some kind of hyper-relativistic transport would still be using radio telescopes of recognizable design, no matter how massive the scale. It seemed backward of the Vegans. Unimaginative. She understood the advantage of putting the telescopes in polar orbit around the star, safe except for twice each revolution from collisions with ring plane debris. But radio telescopes pointing all over the sky, thousands of them, suggested some comprehensive sky survey, an Argus in earnest. Innumerable candidate worlds were being watched for television transmission, military radar, and perhaps other varieties of early radio transmission unknown on Earth. Did they find such signals often, she wondered? Or was the Earth their first success in a million years of looking? There was no sign of a welcoming committee. Was a delegation from the provinces so unremarkable that no one had been assigned even to note their arrival? When the lens was returned to her, she took great care with focus, f-stop, and exposure time. She wanted a permanent record to show the National Science Foundation what really serious radio astronomy was like. She wished there were a way to determine the size of the polyhedral world. The telescopes covered it like barnacles on a whale. A radio telescope in zero G could be essentially any size. After the pictures were developed, she would be able to determine the angular size, maybe a few minutes of arc. But the linear size, the real dimensions, that was impossible to figure out, unless you knew how far away the thing was. Nevertheless, she sensed it was vast. "If there are no worlds here," she was saying, "then there are no Vegans. No one lives here. Vega is only a guardhouse, a place for the Border Patrol to warm their hands. Those radio telescopes," he glanced upward, "are the watchtowers of the Great Wall. If you are limited by the speed of light, it is difficult to hold a galactic empire together. You order the garrison to put down a rebellion. 10,000 years later, you find out what happened. Not good, too slow. So you give autonomy to the garrison commanders. Then, no more empire. But those," and now he gestured at the receding blot covering the sky behind them, "those are imperial roads. Persia had them. Rome had them. China had them. Then you are not restricted to the speed of light. With roads, you can hold an empire together." But Ada, lost in thought, was shaking his head. Something about the physics was bothering him. The black hole, if that was what it really was, could now be seen orbiting Vega in a broad lane entirely clear of debris. Both inner and outer rings gave it wide berth. It was hard to believe how black it was. As she took short video pans of the debris ring before her, she wondered whether it would someday form its own planetary system. The particles colliding, sticking, growing ever larger, gravitational condensations taking place, until at last only a few large worlds orbited the star. It was very like the picture astronomers had of the origin of the planets around the sun 4.5 billion years ago. She could now make out inhomogeneities in the rings, places with a discernible bulge where some debris had apparently accreted together. The motion of the black hole around Vega was creating a visible ripple in the bands of debris immediately adjacent. The dodecahedron was doubtless producing some more modest wake. She wondered if these gravitational perturbations, these spreading rarefactions and condensations, would have any long-term consequence, changing the pattern of subsequent planetary formation. If so, then the very existence of some planet billions of years in the future might be due to the black hole and the machine, and therefore to the message, and therefore to Project Argus. She knew she was overpersonalizing. Had she never lived, some other radio astronomer would surely have received the message, but earlier or later. The machine would have been activated at a different moment, and the dodec would have found its way here in some other time. So some future planet in this system might still owe its existence to her. Then, by symmetry, she had snatched out of existence some other world that was destined to form had she never lived. It was vaguely burdensome, being responsible by your innocent actions for the fates of unknown worlds. She attempted a panning shot, beginning inside the dodecahedron, then out to the struts joining the transparent pentagonal panels, and beyond to the gap in the debris rings, in which they, along with the black hole, were orbiting. She followed the gap, flanked by two bluish rings, further and further from her. There was something a little odd up ahead, a kind of bowing in the adjacent inner ring. "Kramu," she said, handing him the long lens, "look over there. Tell me what you see." "Ue," she pointed again. After a moment, he had found it. She could tell because of his slight but quite unmistakable intake of breath.
"Another black hole," he said. "Much bigger."
They were falling again. This time the tunnel was more commodious, and they were making better time.
"That's it?" Ellie found herself shouting at Davy. "They take us to Vega to show off their black holes? They give us a look at their radio telescopes from 1,000 kilometers away? We spend 10 minutes there and they pop us into another black hole and ship us back to Earth? That's why we spent $2 trillion? "Maybe we're beside the point," Lunacharsky was saying. "Maybe the only real point was to plug themselves into the Earth."
She imagined nocturnal excavations beneath the gates of Troy. Ada, fingers of both hands outspread, was making a calming gesture.
"Wait and see," he said. "This is a different tunnel. Why should you think it goes back to Earth?" "Vega's not where we're intended to go?" Davy asked.
"The experimental method. Let's see where we pop out next."
In this tunnel, there was less scraping of the walls and fewer undulations. Ada and Vega were debating a space-time diagram they had drawn in Kruskal Sakari's coordinates. Ellie had no idea what they were talking about. The deceleration stage, the part of the passage that felt uphill, was still disconcerting. This time, the light at the end of the tunnel was orange. They emerged at a considerable speed into the system of a contact binary, two suns touching. The outer layers of a swollen, elderly red giant star were pouring onto the photosphere of a vigorous, middle-aged yellow dwarf, something like the sun. The zone of contact between the two stars was brilliant. She looked for debris rings or planets or orbiting radio observatories, but could find none. "Well, that doesn't mean very much," she told herself. "These systems could have a fair number of planets, and I'd never know it with this dinky long lens." She projected the double sun onto the piece of paper and photographed the image with a short focal length lens. Because there were no rings, there was less scattered light in this system than around Vega. With the wide-angle lens, she was able, after a bit of searching, to recognize a constellation that sufficiently resembled the Big Dipper. But she had difficulty recognizing the other constellations. Since the bright stars in the Big Dipper are a few hundred light-years from Earth, she concluded that they had not jumped more than a few hundred light-years. She told this to Ada and asked him what he thought.
"What do I think? I think this is an underground." "An underground?"
She recalled her sensation of falling into the depths of hell, it had seemed for a moment, just after the machine had been activated.
"A metro? A subway? These are the stations, the stops. Vega and this system
and others, passengers get on and off at the stops. You change trains here.
He gestured at the contact binary, and she noticed that his hand cast two shadows, one anti-yellow and the other anti-red, like in, it was the only image that came to mind, a discotheque.
But we cannot get off, Ada continued. We are in a closed railway car. We are headed for the terminal, the end of the line.
Drumlin had called such speculations fantasy land, and this was, so far as she knew, the first time Ada had succumbed to the temptation. Of the five, she was the only observational astronomer, even though her specialty was not in the optical spectrum. She felt it her responsibility to accumulate as much data as possible in the tunnels and in the ordinary four-dimensional space-time into which they would periodically emerge. The presumptive black hole from which they exited would always be in orbit around some star or multiple star system. They were always in pairs, always two of them sharing a similar orbit, one from which they were ejected and another into which they fell. No two systems were closely similar. None was very like the solar system. All provided instructive astronomical insights. Not one of them exhibited anything like an artifact, a second dodecahedron, or some vast engineering project to take apart a world and reassemble it into what she had called a device. At this time, they emerged near a star visibly changing its brightness. She could tell from the progression of F-stops required. Perhaps it was one of the RR Lyra stars. Next was a quintuple system, then a feebly luminous brown dwarf. Some were in open space. Some were embedded in nebulosity, surrounded by glowing molecular clouds. She recalled the warning, "This will be deducted from your share in paradise." Nothing had been deducted from hers. Despite a conscious effort to retain a professional calm, her heart soared at this profusion of suns. She hoped that every one of them was a home to someone, or would be one day. But after the fourth jump, she began to worry. Subjectively and by her wristwatch, it felt something like an hour since they had left Hokkaido. If this took much longer, the absence of amenities would be felt. Probably there were aspects of human physiology that could not be deduced, even after attentive television viewing by a very advanced civilization. And if the extraterrestrials were so smart, why were they putting us through so many little jumps? All right, maybe the hop from Earth used rudimentary equipment because only primitives were working one side of the tunnel. But after Vega, why couldn't they jump us directly to wherever the dodec was going? Each time she came barreling out of a tunnel, she was expectant. What wonders had they in store for her next? It put her in mind of a very upscale amusement park, and she found herself imagining Haddon peering down his telescope at Hokkaido the moment the machine had been activated. As glorious as the vistas offered by the message makers were, and however much she enjoyed a kind of proprietary mastery of the subject as she explained some aspect of stellar evolution to the others, she was, after a time, disappointed. She had to work to track the feeling down. Soon she had it. The extraterrestrials were boasting. It was unseemly. It betrayed some defect of character. As they plunged down still another tunnel, this one broader and more tortuous than the others, Lunacharsky asked Ada to guess why the subway stops were put in such unpromising star systems.
Why not around a single star, a young star in good health and with no debris?
Because, Ada replied, of course, I am only guessing, as you ask, because all such systems are inhabited, and they don't want the tourists scaring the natives, Sukhavati shot back.
Ada smiled.
Or the other way around.
But that's what you mean, isn't it? There's some sort of ethic of non-interference with primitive planets. They know that every now and then some of the primitives might use the subway.
And they're pretty sure of the primitives, Ellie continued the thought. But they can't be absolutely sure. After all, primitives are primitive. So you let them ride only on subways that go to the sticks. The builders must be a very cautious bunch. But then why did they send us a local train and not an express?
Probably. It's too hard to build an express tunnel, said she, years of digging experience behind him.
Ellie thought of the Honshu Hokkaido Tunnel, one of the prides of civil engineering on Earth, all of 51 kilometers long. A few of the turns were quite steep now. She thought about her Thunderbird, and then she thought about getting sick. She decided she would fight it as long as she could. The dodecahedron had not been equipped with air sickness bags. Abruptly, they were on a straightaway, and then the sky was full of stars. Everywhere she looked, there were stars. Not the paltry scattering of a few thousand, still occasionally known to naked-eye observers on Earth, but a vast multitude, many almost touching their nearest neighbors, it seemed, surrounding her in every direction, many of them tinted yellow or blue or red, especially red. The sky was blazing with nearby suns. She could make out an immense spiraling cloud of dust, an accretion disk apparently flowing into a black hole of staggering proportions, out of which flashes of radiation were coming like heat lightning on a summer's night. If this was the center of the galaxy, as she suspected, it would be bathed in synchrotron radiation. She hoped the extraterrestrials had remembered how frail humans were. And swimming into her field of view as the dodec rotated was a prodigy, a wonder, a miracle. They were upon it almost before they knew it. It filled half the sky. Now they were flying over it. On its surface were hundreds, perhaps thousands, of illuminated doorways, each a different shape. Many were polygonal or circular or with an elliptical cross-section. Some had projecting appendages or a sequence of partly overlapping off-center circles. She realized they were docking ports, thousands of different docking ports. Some perhaps only meters in size, others clearly kilometers across or larger. Every one of them, she decided, was the template of some interstellar machine like this one. Big creatures and serious machines had imposing entry ports. Little creatures, like us, had tiny ports. It was a democratic arrangement, with no hint of particularly privileged civilizations. The diversity of ports suggested few social distinctions among the sundry civilizations, but it implied a breathtaking diversity of beings and cultures. Talk about Grand Central Station, she thought. The vision of a populated galaxy, of a universe spilling over with life and intelligence, made her want to cry for joy. They were approaching a yellow-lit port, which Ellie could see was the exact template of the dodecahedron in which they were riding. She watched a nearby docking port, where something the size of the dodecahedron and shaped approximately like a starfish was gently insinuating itself onto its template. She glanced left and right, up and down, at the almost imperceptible curvature of this great station, situated at what she guessed was the center of the Milky Way. What a vindication for the human species! Invited here at last. There's hope for us, she thought. There's hope. Well, it isn't Bridgeport. She said this aloud, as the docking maneuver completed itself in perfect silence.
Chapter 20. Grand Central Station. All things are artificial, for nature is the art of God. Thomas Brown, On Dreams, Religio Medici, 1642. Angels need an assumed body, not for themselves, but on our account. Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologica, 151-2. The devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. William Shakespeare, Hamlet, 2-2-628. The airlock was designed to accommodate only one person at a time. When questions of priority had come up, which nation would be first represented on the planet of another star, the five had thrown up their hands in disgust and told the project managers that this wasn't that kind of mission. They had conscientiously avoided discussing the issue among themselves. Both the interior and the exterior doors of the airlock opened simultaneously. They had given no command. Apparently, this sector of Grand Central was adequately pressurized and oxygenated.
Well, who wants to go first? Davy asked.
Video camera in hand, Ellie waited in line to exit, but then decided that the palm frond should be with her when she set foot on this new world. As she went to retrieve it, she heard a whoop of delight from outside, probably from Vege. Ellie rushed into the bright sunlight. The threshold of the airlock's exterior doorway was flush with the sand. Davy was ankle-deep in the water, playfully splashing in Shee's direction. Ada was smiling broadly. It was a beach. Waves were lapping on the sand. The blue sky sported a few lazy cumulus clouds. There was a stand of palm trees irregularly spaced a little back from the water's edge. A sun was in the sky. One sun. A yellow one. Just like ours, she thought. A faint aroma was in the air. Cloves, perhaps, and cinnamon. It could have been a beach on Zanzibar. So they had voyaged 30,000 light years to walk on a beach. Could be worse, she thought. The breeze stirred and a little whirlwind of sand was created before her. Was all this just some elaborate simulation of the Earth, perhaps reconstructed from the data returned by a routine scouting expedition millions of years earlier? Or had the five of them undertaken this epic voyage only to improve their knowledge of descriptive astronomy and then been unceremoniously dumped into some pleasant corner of the Earth? When she turned, she discovered that the dodecahedron had disappeared. They had left the superconducting supercomputer and its reference library as well as some of the instruments aboard. It worried them for about a minute. They were safe, and they had survived a trip worth writing home about. Vege glanced from the frond she had struggled to bring here to the colony of palm trees along the beach and laughed.
"Calls to Newcastle," Davy commented.
But her frond was different. Perhaps they had different species here. Or maybe the local variety had been produced by an inattentive manufacturer. She looked out to sea. Irresistibly brought to mind was the image of the first colonization of the Earth's land some 400 million years ago. Wherever this was, the Indian Ocean or the center of the galaxy, the five of them had done something unparalleled. The itinerary and destinations were entirely out of their hands, it was true. But they had crossed the ocean of interstellar space and begun what surely must be a new age in human history. She was very proud. She removed his boots and rolled up to his knees the legs of the tacky insignia-laden jumpsuit the governments had decreed they all must wear. He ambled through the gentle surf. Davy stepped behind a palm tree and emerged, sari-clad, her jumpsuit draped over her arm. It reminded Ellie of a Dorothy L'Amour movie. Ada produced the sort of linen hat that was his visual trademark throughout the world. Ellie videotaped them in short, jumpy takes. It would look when they got home exactly like a home movie. She joined She and Vege in the surf. The water seemed almost warm. It was a pleasant afternoon, and everything considered a welcome change from the Hokkaido winter they had left little more than an hour before.
"Everyone has brought something symbolic," said Vege, "except me."
"How do you mean?"
"Sukhavati and Ada bring national costumes. She here has brought a grain of rice."
Indeed, she was holding the grain in a plastic bag between thumb and forefinger.
"You have your palm frond," Vege continued. "But me, I have brought no symbols, no mementos from Earth. I'm the only real materialist in the group, and everything I've brought is in my head."
Ellie had hung her medallion around her neck under the jumpsuit. Now she loosened the collar and pulled out the pendant. Vege noticed, and she gave it to him to read.
It's Plutarch, I think, he said after a moment. Those were brave words the Spartans spoke. But remember, the Romans won the battle.
From the tone of this admonition, Vege must have thought the medallion a gift from Dirhir. She was warmed by his disapproval of Ken, surely justified by events, and by his steadfast solicitude. She took his arm.
"Ah, I would kill for a cigarette,"
he said amiably, using his arm to squeeze her hand to his side. The five of them sat together by a little tide pool. The breaking of the surf generated a soft, white noise that reminded her of Argus and her years of listening to cosmic static. The sun was well past the zenith over the ocean. A crab scuttled by, sidewise dexterous, its eyes swiveling on their stalks. With crabs, coconuts, and the limited provisions in their pockets, they could survive comfortably enough for some time. There were no footprints on the beach besides their own.
We think they did almost all the work,
Vege was explaining, his and Ada's thinking on what the five of them had experienced.
All the project did was to make the faintest pucker in space-time, so they would have something to hook their tunnel onto. In all of that multidimensional geometry, it must be very difficult to detect a tiny pucker in space-time. Even harder to fit a nozzle onto it.
What are you saying? They changed the geometry of space?
Yes. We are saying that space is topologically non-simply connected. It's like, I know Abonema doesn't like this analogy, but it's like a flat, two-dimensional surface. The smart surface. Connected by some maze of tubing with some other flat, two-dimensional surface. The dumb surface. The only way you can get from the smart surface to the dumb surface in a reasonable time is through the tubes. Now imagine that the people on the smart surface lower a tube with a nozzle on it. They will make a tunnel between the two surfaces, provided the dumb ones cooperate by making a little pucker on their surface so the nozzle can attach itself. So the smart guys send a radio message and tell the dumb ones how to make a pucker. But if they're truly two-dimensional beings, how could they make a pucker on their surface?
By accumulating a great deal of mass in one place,
Vege said this tentatively.
But that's not what we did.
I know. Somehow the Benzels did it.
You see, Ada explained softly, if the tunnels are black holes, there are real contradictions implied. There is an interior tunnel in the exact Kerr solution of the Einstein field equations, but it's unstable. The slightest perturbation would seal it off and convert the tunnel into a physical singularity through which nothing can pass. I have tried to imagine a superior civilization that would control the internal structure of a collapsing star to keep the interior tunnel stable. This is very difficult. The civilization would have to monitor and stabilize the tunnel forever. It would be especially difficult with something as large as the dodecahedron falling through.
Even if Abonema can discover how to keep the tunnel open, there are many other problems, Vege said. Too many. Black holes collect problems faster than they collect matter. There are the tidal forces. We should have been torn apart in the black hole's gravitational field. We should have been stretched like people in the paintings of El Greco or the sculptures of that Italian...
He turned to Ellie to fill in the blank.
Giacometti,
she suggested. He was Swiss.
Ah, yes, like Giacometti. Then other problems. As measured from Earth, it takes an infinite amount of time for us to pass through a black hole, and we could never, never return to Earth. Maybe this is what happened. Maybe we will never go home. Then there should be an inferno of radiation near the singularity. This is a quantum mechanical instability.
And finally, Ada continued, a Kerr-type tunnel can lead to grotesque causality violations. With a modest change of trajectory inside the tunnel, one could emerge from the other end as early in the history of the universe as you might like. A picosecond after the Big Bang, for example. That would be a very disorderly universe.
Look, fellas, she said, I'm no expert in general relativity. But didn't we see black holes? Didn't we fall into them? Didn't we emerge out of them? Isn't a gram of observation worth a ton of theory?
I know, Vege said in mild agony. It has to be something else. Our understanding of physics can't be so far off, can it?
He addressed this last question a little plaintively to Ada, who only replied, A naturally occurring black hole can't be a tunnel. They have impassable singularities at their centers. With a jerry-rigged sextant and their wristwatches, they timed the angular motion of the setting sun. It was 360 degrees in 24 hours, Earth standard. Before the sun got too low on the horizon, they disassembled Ellie's camera and used the lens to start a fire. She kept the frond by her side, fearful that someone would carelessly throw it on the flames after dark. She proved to be an expert firemaker. He positioned them upwind and kept the fire low. Gradually the stars came out. They were all there, the familiar constellations of Earth. She volunteered to stay up a while, tending the fire while the others slept. She wanted to see Lyra rise. After some hours it did. The night was exceptionally clear, and Vega shone steady and brilliant. From the apparent motion of the constellations across the sky, from the southern hemisphere constellations that she could make out, and from the Big Dipper lying near the northern horizon, she deduced that they were in tropical latitudes. If all this is a simulation, she thought before falling asleep, they've gone to a great deal of trouble. She had an odd little dream. The five of them were swimming, naked, unself-conscious, underwater, now poised lazily near a staghorn coral, now gliding into crannies that were the next moment obscured by drifting seaweed. Once she rose to the surface. A ship in the shape of a dodecahedron flew by, low above the water. The walls were transparent, and inside she could see people in dhotis and sarongs, reading newspapers and casually conversing. She dove back underwater, where she belonged. Although the dream seemed to go on for a long time, none of them had any difficulty breathing. They were inhaling and exhaling water. They felt no distress. Indeed, they were swimming as naturally as fish. Vega even looked a little like a fish, a grouper, perhaps. The water must be fiercely oxygenated, she supposed. In the midst of the dream, she remembered a mouse she had once seen in a physiology laboratory. Perfectly content, in a flask of oxygenated water, even paddling hopefully with its little front feet. A vermiform tail streamed behind. She tried to remember how much oxygen was needed, but it was too much trouble. She was thinking less and less, she thought. Well, that's all right. Really. The others were now distinctly fish-like. Davy's fins were translucent. It was obscurely interesting, vaguely sensual. She hoped it would continue, so she could figure something out. But even the question she wanted to answer eluded her. Oh, to breathe warm water, she thought. What will they think of next? Ellie awoke with a sense of disorientation so profound it bordered on vertigo. Where was she? Wisconsin? Puerto Rico? New Mexico? Wyoming? Hokkaido? Or the Strait of Malacca? Then she remembered. It was unclear to within 30,000 light-years where in the Milky Way galaxy she was. Probably the all-time record for disorientation, she thought. Despite the headache, Ellie laughed, and Davy, sleeping beside her, stirred. Because of the upward slope of the beach, they had reconnoitered out to a kilometer or so the previous afternoon and found not a hint of habitation. Direct sunlight had not yet reached her. Ellie was recumbent on a pillow of sand. Davy, just awakening, had slept with her head on the rolled-up jumpsuit. "Don't you think there's something Candy asked about a culture that needs soft pillows?" Ellie asked. "The ones who put their heads in wooden yokes at night, that's who the smart money's on." Davy laughed and wished her good morning. They could hear shouting from farther up the beach. The three men were waving and beckoning. Ellie and Davy roused themselves and joined them. Standing upright on the sand was a door. A wooden door, with paneling and a brass doorknob. Anyway, it looked like brass. The door had black painted metal hinges and was set in two jambs, a lintel and a threshold. No nameplate. It was in no way extraordinary. For Earth. "Now, go round the back," she invited. From the back, the door was not there at all. She could see Ada and Vega and she, Davy, standing a little apart, and the sand continuous between the four of them and her. She moved to the side, the heels of her feet moistened by the surf, and she could make out a single dark, razor-thin vertical line. She was reluctant to touch it. Returning to the back again, she satisfied herself that there were no shadows or reflections in the air before her, and then stepped through. "Bravo!" Ada laughed. She turned around and found the closed door before her. "What did you see?" she asked. "A lovely woman strolling through a closed door 2 centimeters thick." Vege seemed to be doing well, despite the dearth of cigarettes. "Have you tried opening the door?" she asked.
"Not yet,"
she replied. She stepped back again, admiring the apparition.
"It looks like something by, what's the name of that French surrealist?" Vege asked.
"René Magritte," she answered. "He was Belgian."
"We're agreed, I take it, that this isn't really the Earth,"
Davy proposed, her gesture encompassing ocean, beach, and sky.
"Unless we're in the Persian Gulf 3,000 years ago and there are jinns about," Ellie laughed.
"Aren't you impressed by the care of the construction?"
"All right," Ellie answered. "They're very good. I'll grant them that.
But what's it for? Why go to the trouble of all this detail work?"
Maybe they just have a passion for getting things right.
Or maybe they're just showing off.
I don't see, Davy continued, how they could know our doors so well. Think of how many different ways there are to make a door. How could they know?
It could be television, Ellie responded. Vega has received television signals from Earth up to, let's see, 1974 programming. Clearly they can send the interesting clips here by special delivery in no time flat. Probably there have been a lot of doors on television between 1936 and 1974.
Okay, she continued, as if this were not a change of subject. What do we think would happen if we opened the door and walked in?
If we are here to be tested, said she, on the other side of that door is probably the test. Maybe one for each of us.
He was ready. She wished she were. The shadows of the nearest palms were now falling on the beach. Wordlessly, they regarded one another. All four of them seemed eager to open the door and step through. She alone felt some reluctance. She asked Edda if he would like to go first. We might as well put our best foot forward, she thought. He doffed his cap, made a slight but graceful bow, turned, and approached the door. Ellie ran to him and kissed him on both cheeks. The others embraced him also. He turned again, opened the door, entered, and disappeared into thin air, his striding foot first, his trailing hand last. With the door ajar, there had seemed to be only the continuation of beach and surf behind him. The door closed. She ran around it, but there was no trace of Ada. She was next. Ellie found herself struck by how docile they all had been, instantly obliging every anonymous invitation proffered. They could have told us where they were taking us and what all this was for, she thought. It could have been part of the message, or information conveyed after the machine was activated. They could have told us we were docking with a simulation of a beach on Earth. They could have told us to expect the door. True, as accomplished as they are, the extraterrestrials might know English imperfectly, with television as their only tutor. Their knowledge of Russian, Mandarin, Tamil, and Hausa would be even more rudimentary. But they had invented the language introduced in the message primer. Why not use it? To retain the element of surprise? Vege saw her staring at the closed door and asked if she wished to enter next.
Thanks, Vege. I've been thinking. I know it's a little crazy, but it just struck me. Why do we have to jump through every hoop they hold out for us? Suppose we don't do what they ask. Ellie, you are so American. For me, this is just like home. I'm used to doing what the authorities suggest, especially when I have no choice.
He smiled and turned smartly on his heel.
Don't take any crap from the Grand Duke, she called after him.
High above, a gull squawked. Vege had left the door ajar. There was still only beach beyond.
Are you all right?
Davy asked her. Oh, I'm okay. Really, I just want a moment to myself. I'll be along.
Seriously, I'm asking as a doctor. Do you feel all right?
I woke up with a headache, and I think I had some very fanciful dreams. I haven't brushed my teeth or had my black coffee. I wouldn't mind reading the morning paper either. Except for all that, really, I'm fine.
Well, that sounds all right. For that matter, I have a bit of a headache, too. Take care of yourself, Ellie. Remember everything so you'll be able to tell it to me. Next time we meet.
I will, Ellie promised. They kissed and wished each other well. Davy stepped over the threshold and vanished. The door closed behind her. Afterward, Ellie thought she had caught a whiff of curry.
She brushed her teeth in salt water. A certain fastidious streak had always been a part of her nature. She breakfasted on coconut milk. Carefully, she brushed accumulated sand off the exterior surfaces of the microcamera system and its tiny arsenal of video cassettes on which she had recorded wonders. She washed the palm frond in the surf, as she had done the day she found it on Cocoa Beach, just before the launch up to Methuselah. The morning was already warm, and she decided to take a swim. Her clothes carefully folded on the palm frond, she strode boldly out into the surf. Whatever else, she thought, the extraterrestrials are unlikely to find themselves aroused by the sight of a naked woman, even if she is pretty well preserved. She tried to imagine a microbiologist stirred to crimes of passion after viewing a paramecium caught in flagrante delicto in mitosis. Languidly, she floated on her back, bobbing up and down, her slow rhythm in phase with the arrival of successive wave crests. She tried to imagine thousands of comparable chambers, simulated worlds, whatever these were, each a meticulous copy of the nicest part of someone's home planet. Thousands of them, each with sky and weather, ocean, geology, and indigenous life indistinguishable from the originals. It seemed an extravagance, although it also suggested that a satisfactory outcome was within reach. No matter what your resources, you don't manufacture a landscape on this scale for 5 specimens from a doomed world. On the other hand, the idea of extraterrestrials as zookeepers had become something of a cliché. What if this sizable station, with its profusion of docking ports and environments, was actually a zoo? See the exotic animals in their native habitats, she imagined some snail-headed barker shouting. Tourists come from all over the galaxy, especially during school vacations. And then when there's a test, the station masters temporarily move the critters and the tourists out, sweep the beach free of footprints, and give the newly arriving primitives a half day of rest and recreation before the test ordeal begins. Or maybe this was how they stocked the zoos. She thought about the animals locked away in terrestrial zoos, who were said to have experienced difficulties breeding in captivity. Somersaulting in the water, she dived beneath the surface in a moment of self-consciousness. She took a few strong strokes in toward the beach, and for the second time in 24 hours, wished that she had had a baby. There was no one about, and not a sail on the horizon. A few seagulls were stalking the beach, apparently looking for crabs. She wished she had brought some bread to give them. After she was dry, she dressed and inspected the doorway again. It was merely waiting. She felt a continuing reluctance to enter. More than reluctance, maybe dread. She withdrew, keeping it in view. Beneath a palm tree, her knees drawn up under her chin, she looked out over the long sweep of white sandy beach. After a while, she got up and stretched a little. Carrying the frond and the microcamera with one hand, she approached the door and turned the knob. It opened slightly. Through the crack, she could see the whitecaps offshore. She gave it another push, and it swung open without a squeak. The beach, bland and disinterested, stared back at her. She shook her head and returned to the tree, resuming her pensive posture. She wondered about the others. Were they now in some outlandish testing facility, avidly checking away on the multiple-choice questions? Or was it an oral examination? And who were the examiners? She felt the uneasiness well up once again. Another intelligent being, independently evolved on some distant world under unearthly physical conditions, and with an entirely different sequence of random genetic mutations. Such a being would not resemble anyone she knew, or even imagined. If this was a test station, then there were station masters, and the station masters would be thoroughly, devastatingly non-human. There was something deep within her that was bothered by insects, snakes, star-nosed moles. She was someone who felt a little shudder, well, to speak plainly, a tremor of loathing when confronted with even slightly malformed human beings. Cripples, children with Down syndrome, even the appearance of Parkinsonism evoked in her, against her clear intellectual resolve, a feeling of disgust, a wish to flee. Generally, she had been able to contain her fear, although she wondered if she had ever hurt someone because of it. It wasn't something she thought about much. She would sense her own embarrassment and move on to another topic. But now she worried that she would be unable even to confront, much less to win over for the human species, an extraterrestrial being. They hadn't thought to screen the five for that. There had been no effort to determine whether they were afraid of mice or dwarfs or Martians. It had simply not occurred to the examining committees. She wondered why they hadn't thought of it. It seemed an obvious enough point now. It had been a mistake to send her. Perhaps when confronted with some serpent-haired galactic station master, she would disgrace herself. Or far worse, tip the grade given to the human species in whatever unfathomable test was being administered from pass to fail. She looked with both apprehension and longing at the enigmatic door, its lower boundary now underwater. The tide was coming in. There was a figure on the beach a few hundred meters away. At first she thought it was Vege, perhaps out of the examining room early and come to tell her the good news. But whoever it wasn't wearing a machine project jumpsuit. Also, it seemed to be someone younger, more vigorous. She reached for the long lens, and for some reason hesitated. Standing up, she shielded her eyes from the sun. Just for a moment, it had seemed. It was clearly impossible. They would not take such shameless advantage of her. But she could not help herself. She was racing toward him on the hard sand near the water's edge, her hair streaming behind her. He looked as he had in the most recent picture of him she had seen, vigorous, happy. He had a day's growth of beard. She flew into his arms, sobbing. "Hello, Presh," he said, his right hand stroking the back of her head.